dead fucking last. Just doesn't seem fair, Eve said. It was the other driver's fault.
If it was anybody's fault, Denny said, it was mine, for being where I could get collected.
This is something I'd heard him say before. Getting angry at another driver for a driving incident is pointless. You need to watch the drivers around you, understand their skill, confidence, and aggression levels, and drive with them accordingly. Know who is driving next to you. Any problems that may occur have ultimately been caused by you, because you are responsible for where you are and what you are doing there. Still, fault or no, Denny was crushed. Zoe was crushed. Eve was crushed. I was decimated. We had come so close to greatness, we had smelled it, and it smelled like roast pig. Everybody likes the smell of roast pig. But what is worse, smelling the roast and not feasting, or not smelling the roast at all? August was hot and dry, and the grass all around the neighborhood was brown and dead. Denny spent his time doing math. By his figuring, it was still mathematically possible for him to finish in the top 10 in the series and likely win Rookie of the Year, and either result would assure him of getting another ride the following year. We sat on the back porch, basking in the early evening sun, the smell of Denny's freshly baked oatmeal cookies wafting from the kitchen, Zoe running in the sprinkler, Denny massaging Eve's hand gently, giving it life. I was on the deck doing my best impression of an iguana, soaking up all the heat I could to warm my blood, hoping that if I absorbed enough, it would carry me through the winter, which would likely be harsh, cold, dark, and bitter, as a hot Seattle summer usually portends.
"Maybe it isn't meant to be," Eve said. "It'll happen when it happens," Denny told her.
"But you're never here anymore when I'm ovulating. So come with me next week. Zoe will love it. We'll stay where they have a pool. She loves anything with a pool. And you can come to the track for the race."
"I can't go to the track," Eve said. "Not now. I mean, I wish I could. I really do. But I've been feeling good lately, you know? And I'm afraid. The track is so loud, and it's hot, and it smells like rubber and gas, and the radio blasts static into my ears, and everyone's shouting at each other so they can be heard. It might give me a... I might react badly to it."
Denny smiled and sighed. Even Eve cracked a smile.
"Do you understand?" she asked.
"I do," Denny answered. I did, too. Everything about the track, the sounds, the smells, walking through the paddock and feeling the energy, the heat of race motors emanating from each pit, the electricity that ripples up and down the paddock when the announcer calls the next race group to pre-grid, watching the frantic scramble of a standing start, and then imagining the possibilities, putting together the story of what's going on when the cars are out of sight on other parts of the race circuit until they come around to start finish again in an entirely different order, dodging and drafting and making runs and diving into the next turn that can flip everything upside down again. Denny and I fed off it. It gave us life. But I totally understood that what filled us with energy could be toxic to someone else, especially Eve.
"We could use a turkey baster," Denny said, and Eve laughed hard, harder than I'd seen her laugh in a long time.
"I could leave you with a cup full of potential babies in the refrigerator," he said, and she laughed even harder. I didn't get the joke, but Eve thought it was hysterical. She got up and went into the house, reappearing a moment later with the turkey baster from the kitchen. She scrutinized it with a devious smile, ran her fingers along its length.
"Hmm," she said, "maybe."
They giggled together and looked out to the lawn, and I looked with them, and we all watched Zoe, her wet hair clinging to her shoulders and glistening locks, her childish bikini and tanned feet, pure joy as she ran circles around the sprinkler, her shrieks and squeals and laughs echoing through the Central District streets. 17. Your car goes where your eyes go. We went to Denny Creek, not because it was named after Denny, it wasn't, but because it was such an enjoyable hike. Zoe clumping along in her first pair of waffle stompers, me cut loose of my leash. Summer in the Cascades is always pleasant, cool under the canopy of cedars and alders, the beaten path packed down, making long strides easy. Off the beaten path, where dogs prefer, a soft and spongy bed of fallen needles that rot and feed the trees with a steady trickle of nutrients.
And the smell. The smell would have given me an erection if I'd still had testicles. Richness and fertility. Growth and death and food and decay. Waiting, just waiting for someone to smell it. Lingering close to the ground in layers, each distinct scent with its own aromatic weight, its own place. A good nose like mine can separate each odor, identify, enjoy. I rarely let myself go, practicing to be restrained like men are. But that summer, considering the joy of all that we had, Denny's success and Zoe's exuberance, and even Eve, who was light and free, I ran through those woods that day wildly, like a crazy dog, diving through the bushes over the fallen trees, giving gentle chase to chipmunks, barking at the jays, rolling over and scratching my back on the sticks and leaves and needles and earth. We made our way along the path, up the hills and down, over the roots and past the rock outcroppings, eventually arriving at the slippery slabs, as they are called, where the creek runs over a series of broad, flat rocks, pooling at some points, streaming at others. Children love the slippery slabs as they slide and slice through the sluices and slate. And so we arrived, and I drank the water, cold and fresh, the last of that year's snowmelt. Zoe and Denny and Eve stripped down to their swimsuits and bathed gently in the waters. Zoe was old enough to safely navigate parts herself, and Denny took the lower and Eve took the upper, and they slid Zoe down the stream of water, Eve giving a push and Zoe slipping down. The rocks had traction when dry, but when wet, there was a film on them that made them quite slick. Down she would go, squealing and squirming, splashing into the frigid pool at Denny's feet. He would snatch her up and whisk her back to Eve, who would slide her down again and again. People, like dogs, love repetition. Chasing a ball, lapping a course in a race car, sliding down a slide. Because as much as each incident is similar, so it is different. Denny rushed up the slab and handed off Zoe. He returned to his spot by the pool. Eve lowered Zoe into the water. She screamed and flung herself in play, slid down the slab to be caught by Denny again. Until once. Eve dipped Zoe into the water, but instead of screaming and splashing, Zoe suddenly pulled her toes from the icy water, upsetting Eve's balance. Eve shifted her weight and somehow managed to release Zoe safely onto the dry rock. But her move was too abrupt, too sudden, an overcorrection. Her foot touched the creek, and she didn't realize how slippery those rocks were. Slippery slabs, like glass. Her legs went out from underneath her. She reached out, but her hand grasped only the air. Her fist closed, empty. Her head hit the rock with a loud crack and bounced. It hit and bounced and hit again, like a rubber ball. We stood, it seemed like for a long time, waiting to see what was going to happen. Eve lay unmoving, and there was Zoe, again the cause, not knowing what to do. She looked at her father, who quickly bounded up to them both. "Are you okay?" Eve blinked hard, painfully. There was blood in her mouth. "I bit my tongue," she said woozily. "How's your head?" Denny asked. "Hurts." "Can you make it back to the car?" With me in the lead, herding Zoe, Denny steered Eve. She wasn't staggering, but she was lost, and who knows where she would have ended up if someone hadn't been with her. It was early evening when we got to the hospital in Bellevue. "You probably have a minor concussion," Denny said, "but they should check it out." "I'm okay," Eve repeated over and over. But clearly she wasn't okay. She was dazed and slurring her words, and she kept nodding off, but Denny would wake her up, saying something about not falling asleep when you have a concussion. They all went inside and left me in the car with the windows open a crack. I settled into the pocket-like passenger seat of Denny's BMW 3.0 CSI and forced myself to sleep. When I sleep, I don't feel the urge to urinate nearly as badly as when I am awake. 18. In Mongolia, when a dog dies, he is buried high in the hills so people cannot walk on his grave. The dog's master whispers into the dog's ear his wishes that the dog will return as a man in his next life. Then his tail is cut off and put beneath his head, and a piece of meat or fat is placed in his mouth
to sustain his soul on its journey. Before he is reincarnated, the dog's soul is freed to travel the land, to run across the high desert plains for as long as it would like. I learned that from a program on the National Geographic Channel, so I believe it is true. Not all dogs return as men, they say. Only those who are ready. I am ready. 19. It was hours before Denny returned, and he returned alone. He let me out, and I barely could scramble from the seat before unleashing a torrent of urine on the lamppost in front of me. "Sorry, boy," he said. "I didn't forget about you." When I had finished, he opened a package of peanut butter sandwich crackers he must have gotten from a vending machine. I love those crackers the best. It's the salt and the butter in the crackers mixed with the fat in the peanuts. I tried to eat slowly, savoring each bite, but I was too hungry, and swallowed them so quickly I barely got to taste them. What a shame to waste something so wonderful on a dog. Sometimes I hate what I am so much. We sat on the berm for a long time, not speaking or anything. He seemed upset, and when he was upset, I knew the best thing I could do was be available for him. So I lay next to him and waited. Parking lots are weird places. People love their cars so much when they are moving, but they hurry away from them so quickly when they stop moving. People are loath to sit in a parked car for long. They are afraid someone might judge them for it, I think. The only people who sit in parked cars are police and stalkers, and sometimes taxi drivers on a break, but usually only when they're eating. Whereas me, I can sit in a parked car for hours, and nobody thinks to ask. Odd. I could be a stalker dog, and then what would happen? But in that hospital parking lot, with its very black blacktop, warm like a sweater just removed, and its very white, white lines painted with surgical care, people parked their cars and ran from them, sprinted into the building, or scurried out of the building and into their cars, quick to drive away with no mirror adjustment, no assessment of gauges, like a getaway car. Denny and I sat at length and watched them, the comers and goers, and did nothing more than breathe. We did not need conversation to communicate with each other. After a while, a car pulled into the parking lot and parked near us. It was beautiful. A 1974 Alfa Romeo GTV in pine green with a factory-installed fabric sunroof in mint condition. Mike got out slowly and walked toward us. I greeted him, and he gave me a perfunctory pat on the head. He continued over to Denny and sat down in my spot on the berm. I tried to muster some joy because the mood was definitely down, but Mike pushed me away when I went to nuzzle him. "I appreciate this, Mike," Denny said. "Hey, man, no problem. What about Zoe?" "Eve's dad took her to their house and put her to bed." Mike nodded. The crickets were louder than the traffic from the nearby Interstate 405, but not by much. We listened to them, a concert of crickets, wind, leaves, cars, and fans on the roof of the hospital building. Here's why I will be a good person. Because I listen. I cannot speak, so I listen very well. I never interrupt. I never deflect the course of the conversation with a comment of my own. People, if you pay attention to them, change the direction of one another's conversations constantly. It's like having a passenger in your car who suddenly grabs the steering wheel and turns you down a side street. For instance, if we met at a party and I wanted to tell you a story about the time I needed to get a soccer ball in my neighbor's yard, but his dog chased me and I had to jump into a swimming pool to escape, and I began telling the story, you, hearing the word soccer and neighbor in the same sentence, might interrupt and mention that your childhood neighbor was Pele, the famous soccer player. And I might be courteous and say, "Didn't he play for the Cosmos of New York? Did you grow up in New York?" And you might reply that no, you grew up in Brazil on the streets of Três Corações with Pele. And I might say, "I thought you were from Tennessee." And you might say, "Not originally," and then go on to outline your genealogy at length. So my initial conversation gambit, that I had a funny story about being chased by my neighbor's dog, would be totally lost, and only because you had to tell me all about Pele. Learn to listen. I beg of you. Pretend you are a dog like me and listen to other people rather than steal their stories. I listened that night,
and I heard.
How long will they keep her?
Mike asked. They might not even do a biopsy. They might just go in and get it. Malignant or not, it's still causing problems. The headaches, the nausea, the mood swings.
Really? Mike deadpanned. Mood swings? Maybe my wife has a tumor.
It was a joke line, a throwaway. But Denny didn't have a sense of humor that night. He said sharply, It's not a tumor, Mike. It's a mass. It's not a tumor until they test it.
Sorry, Mike said. I was... sorry.
He grabbed me by the scruff and gave me a shake.
Really rough, he said. I'd be freaking out right now if I were you.
Denny stood up tall. For him. He wasn't a tall guy. He was a Formula One guy. Well-proportioned and powerful, but scaled down. A flyweight.
I am freaking out, he said.
Mike nodded thoughtfully.
You don't look it. I guess that's why you're such a good driver, he said.
And I looked at him quickly. That was just what I was thinking.
You don't mind stopping by my place and getting his stuff?
Denny took out his key ring, picked through the bundle.
The food is in the pantry. Give him a cup and a half. He gets three of those chicken cookies before he goes to bed. Take his bed, it's in the bedroom, and take his dog. Just say, where's your dog? And he'll find it. Sometimes he hides it.
He found the house key and held it out for Mike, letting the other keys dangle.
It's the same for both locks, he said. We'll be fine, Mike said. Do you want me to bring you some clothes?
No, Denny said. I'll go back in the morning and pack a bag if we're staying.
You want me to bring these back?
I have Eves inside.
No words, then. Just crickets, wind, traffic, fans blowing on the roof, a distant siren. You don't have to keep it inside, Mike said. You can let go. We're in a parking lot.
Denny looked down at his shoes, the same old three-quarter boots he liked to hike in. He wanted a new pair, I knew, because he'd told me, but he didn't want to spend the money, he said, and I think he held out hope that someone would give him a pair of boots for a birthday or Christmas or something. But no one ever did. He had 100 pair of driving gloves, but no one ever thought to give him a new pair of hiking boots.
I listen.
He looked up at Mike.
This is why she didn't want to go to the hospital.
What?
Mike asked. This is what she was afraid of.
Mike nodded, but clearly he didn't understand what Denny was saying.
What about your race next week?
He asked.
I'll call Johnny tomorrow and tell him I'm out for the season, Denny said. I have to be here.
Mike took me to our house to get my things. I was humiliated when he said, Where's your dog? I didn't want to admit that I still slept with a stuffed animal, but I did. I loved that dog, and Denny was right. I did hide it during the day because I didn't want Zoe to assimilate it into her collection, and also because when people saw it, they wanted to play tug, and I didn't like tugging with my dog. And also, I was afraid of the virus that had possessed the zebra. But I got my dog out of his hiding spot under the sofa, and we climbed back into Mike's Alpha and went to his house. His wife, who wasn't really a wife, but a man who was wife-like, asked how it all went, and Mike brushed him off right away and poured himself a drink.
That guy's bottled so tight, Mike said. He's gonna have an aneurysm or something.
Mike's wife picked up my dog that I had dropped on the floor.
We have to take this too? He asked.
Listen, Mike sighed. Everyone needs a security blanket. What's wrong with that?
It stinks, Mike's wife said. I'll wash it.
And he put it in the washing machine. My dog. He took the first toy that Denny ever gave me and stuck it into the washing machine. With soap. I couldn't believe it. I was stunned. No one had ever handled my dog in such a way. I watched through the glass window of the machine as it spun around and around, sloshing with the suds. I watched it. And they laughed at me. Not meanly. They thought I was a dumb dog. All people do. They laughed, and I watched, and when it came out, they put it in the dryer with a towel, and I waited. And when it was dry, they took it out and gave it to me. Tony, Mike's wife, took it out, and it was warm, and he handed it to me and said, Much better, right? I wanted to hate him then. I wanted to hate the world. I wanted to hate my own dog, a goofy stuffed animal that Denny gave me when I was just a puppy. I was so angry with how our family had been suddenly torn apart. Zoe stuck with the twins,
Eve sick in a hospital, me shuttled off like a foster child, and now my dog, washed clean of smell. I wanted to push everyone away and go live by myself with my ancestors on the high desert plains of Mongolia and guard the sheep and the ewes from the wolves. When Tony handed me my dog, I took it in my mouth out of respect. I took it to my bed because that's what Denny would have wanted me to do. And I curled up with it. And the irony? I liked it. I liked my stuffed dog better clean than smelly, which was something I never would have imagined, but which gave me something I could hold on to. Some belief that the center of our family could not be fractured by a chance occurrence, an accidental washing, an unexpected illness. Deep in the kernel of our family existed a bond. Denny, Zoe, Eve, me, and even my stuffed dog. However things might change around us, we would always be together. I was not privy to much, being a dog. I was not allowed into the hospital to hear the hushed conversations, the diagnosis, the prognosis, the analysis, to witness the doctor with the blue hat and blue gown whispering his misgivings, revealing the clues they all should have seen, unraveling the mysteries of the brain. No one confided in me. I was never consulted. Nothing was expected of me except that I do my business outside when called upon to do so, and that I stopped barking when told to stop barking. Eve stayed in the hospital for a long time, weeks, because there was so much for Denny to do, caring for both me and Zoe, as well as visiting Eve in the hospital whenever possible. He decided that the best plan was to implement a template system, rather than our usual spontaneous way of living. Whereas before, he and Eve sometimes took Zoe to dinner at a restaurant. Without Eve, we always ate at home. Whereas before, Denny sometimes fed Zoe breakfast at a coffee shop. Without Eve, breakfast was always eaten at home. The days consisted of a series of regimented events. Zoe ate her cereal, while Denny made her a sack lunch consisting of a peanut butter and banana sandwich on whole grain bread, potato chips, the good cookies, and a small bottle of water. Denny then dropped Zoe at her summer camp and continued on to work. At the end of the workday, Denny retrieved Zoe from camp and returned home to cook dinner while Zoe watched cartoons. After dinner, Denny gave me my food and then took Zoe to visit Eve. Later, they returned. Denny bathed Zoe, read her a story, and tucked her into bed. Denny then attended to whatever tasks needed attending, such as paying bills or arguing with the health insurance company about cost overruns and payment schedules and so forth. Weekends were spent largely at the hospital. It was not a very colorful way to live, but it was efficient, and considering the seriousness of Eve's illness, efficient was the best we could expect. My walks were infrequent, my trips to the dog park non-existent. Little attention was paid to me by Denny or Zoe. But I was ready to make that sacrifice in the interest of Eve's well-being and to preserve the family dynamic. I vowed not to be a squeaky wheel in any way. After 2 weeks of this pattern, Maxwell and Trish offered to keep Zoe for a weekend so as to afford Denny a bit of a respite. They told him he looked sickly, that he should take a vacation from his troubles, and Eve agreed. "I don't want to see you this weekend," she said to him. At least that's what he told Zoe and me. Denny was ambivalent about the idea, I could tell as he packed Zoe's overnight bag. He was hesitant to let Zoe go. But he did let her go, and then he and I were alone, and it felt very strange. We did all the things we used to do. We went jogging. We ordered delivery pizza for lunch. We spent the afternoon watching the fantastic movie Le Mans, in which Steve McQueen endures tragedy and pain in the ultimate test of courage and personal fortitude. We watched one of Denny's tapes, featuring an onboard view of the Grand Nürburgring racetrack in Germany, filmed in the track's heyday, when the likes of Jackie Stewart and Jim Clark raced its lengthy 22-kilometer 174-turn Nordschleife, or Northern Loop. After that,
Denny took me to the Blue Dog Park that was a few blocks away, and he threw the ball for me. But even for that venture, our energy was wrong. A dog with darkness about him got after me and was at my throat with bared teeth everywhere I moved, so I couldn't retrieve the tennis ball but was forced to stay close by Denny's side. It all felt wrong. The absence of Eve and Zoe was wrong. There was something missing in everything we did. After we had both eaten dinner, we sat together in the kitchen, fidgeting. There was nothing for us to do but fidget. Because while we were going through the motions, doing what we always used to do, there was no joy in it whatsoever. Finally, Denny stood. He took me outside, and I urinated for him. He gave me my usual bedtime cookies, and then he said to me, "You be good." He said, "I have to go see her." I followed him to the door. I wanted to go see her, too. "No," he said to me. "You stay here. They won't let you into the hospital." I understood. I went to my bed and lay down. "Thanks, Enzo," he said, and then he left. He returned a few hours later, in the darkness, and he silently climbed into his bed with a shiver before the sheets got warm. I lifted my head, and he saw me. "She's going to be okay," he said to me. "She's going to be okay." 21. She made me wear the bumblebee wings she had worn the previous Halloween. She dressed herself in her pink ballet outfit with the tulle skirt and the leotard and stockings. We went out into the backyard and ran around together until her pink feet were stained with dirt. Zoe and me, playing in the backyard on a sunny afternoon. It was the Tuesday after her weekend with Maxwell and Trish, and by then she had thankfully lost the sour vinegar smell that clung to her whenever she spent time at the twins' house. Denny had left work early and picked up Zoe so they could go shopping for new sneakers and socks. When they got home, Denny cleaned the house while Zoe and I played. We danced and laughed and ran and pretended we were angels. She called me over to the corner of the yard by the spigot. On the wood chips lay one of her Barbie dolls. She kneeled down before it. "You're going to be okay," she said to the doll. "Everything is going to be okay." She unfolded a dishcloth that she'd brought from the house. In the dishcloth were scissors, a Sharpie pen, and masking tape. She pulled off the doll's head. She took the kitchen scissors and cut off Barbie's hair down to the plastic nub. She then drew a line on the doll's skull, all the while whispering softly, "Everything's going to be okay." When she was done, she tore off a piece of masking tape and put it on the doll's head. She pressed the head back onto the neck stub and laid the doll down. We both stared at it. A moment of silence. "Now she can go to heaven," Zoe said to me, "and I'll live with Grandma and Grandpa." I was disheartened. Clearly, the weekend of respite Maxwell and Trish had offered Denny was a false one. I had no clear evidence, and yet I could sense it. For the twins, it had been a working weekend, an effort to establish an agenda. They were already sowing the seeds of their story, spinning the yarn of their propaganda, prophesying a future they hoped would come true. 22. Soon, Labor Day weekend came, and after that, Zoe was enrolled in school. Real school, as she called it. Kindergarten. And she was so excited to go. She picked out her clothes the night before her first day, bell-bottom jeans and sneakers and a bright yellow blouse. She had her backpack, her lunchbox, her pencil case, her notebook. With great ceremony, Denny and I walked with her a block from our house to the corner of Martin Luther King Jr. Way, and we waited for the bus that would take her to her new elementary school. We waited with a few other kids and parents from the neighborhood. When the bus trundled over the hill, we were all so excited. "Kiss me now," she said to Denny.
"Now?"
"Not when the bus is here. I don't want Jesse to see." Jesse was her best friend from preschool, who was going to be in the same kindergarten class. Denny obliged and kissed her before the bus had stopped. "After school, you go to extended day," he said, "like we practiced yesterday at orientation, remember?"
"Daddy,"
she scolded. "I'll pick you up after extended day. You wait in the classroom and I'll come and get you."
"Daddy!"
She made a stern face at him, and for a second I could have sworn she was Eve. The flashing eyes, the flared nostrils, the balanced stance and arms akimbo, the head cocked, ready for battle. She quickly turned and climbed onto the bus, and as she walked down the aisle, she turned and waved at us both before she took her seat next to her friend. The bus pulled away and headed for school.
"You first?"
another father asked Denny.
"Yeah," Denny replied. "My only. You?"
"My third," the man said. "But there's nothing like your first. They grow up so fast."
"That they do,"
Denny said with a smile. We turned and walked home. 23. Everything they said made sense, but none of it added up properly in my mind. It was an evening on which Denny took me along to the hospital to visit Eve, though I didn't get to go inside. After the visit, Zoe and I waited in the car, while Maxwell and Trish joined Denny for a conference on the pavement. Zoe was immersed in a book of mazes, something she loved to do. I listened carefully to the conversation. Maxwell and Trish did all of the talking.
"Of course there has to be a nurse on duty, around the clock."
"They work in shifts."
"They work in shifts, but still, the one on duty takes breaks."
"So someone needs to be there to help."
"And since we're always around..."
"We have nowhere to go."
"And you have to work."
"So it's best."
"Yes, it's best."
Denny nodded without conviction. He got into the car and we drove off.
"When's Mommy coming home?" Zoe asked.
"Soon," Denny said. We were crossing the floating bridge, the one Zoe used to call the High 90 when she was younger.
"Mommy's going to stay with Grandma and Grandpa for a while," Denny said, "until she feels better. Is that okay with you?"
"I guess,"
Zoe said.
"Why?"
"It'll be easier from..." He broke off. "It'll be easier."
A few days later, a Saturday, Zoe, Denny, and I went to Maxwell and Trisha's house. A bed had been set up in the living room, a large hospital bed that moved up and down and tilted and did all sorts of things by touching a remote control, and that had a broad footboard from which hung a clipboard, and that came stocked with a nurse, a crinkly, older woman who had a voice that sounded like she was singing whenever she spoke, and who didn't like dogs, though I had no objection to her whatsoever. Immediately, the nurse started fretting about me. To my dismay, Maxwell concurred, and Denny was preoccupied, so I was shoved outside into the backyard. Thankfully, Zoe came to my rescue.
"Mommy's coming,"
Zoe told me. She was very excited, and wore the madras dress that she liked because it was so pretty. And I found her excitement infectious, so I joined in with it. I embraced the festivity, a real homecoming. Zoe and I played. She threw a ball for me, and I did tricks for her, and we rolled together in the grass. It was a wonderful day. The family all together again. It felt very special.
"She's here,"
Denny called from the back door, and Zoe and I rushed to see. This time I was allowed inside. Eve's mother entered the house first, followed by a man in blue slacks and a yellow shirt with a logo on it, who wheeled in a white figure with dead eyes, a mannequin in slippers. Maxwell and Denny lifted the figure and placed it in the bed, and the nurse tucked it in. And Zoe said,
"Hi, Mommy."
And all this happened before it even entered my consciousness that this strange figure was not a dummy, not a mock-up used for practice, but Eve. Her head was covered with a stocking cap. Her cheeks were sunken, her skin sallow. She lifted her head and looked around.
"I feel like a Christmas tree," she said. "In the living room, everyone's standing around me expecting something. I don't have any presents."
Uncomfortable chuckles from the onlookers. And then she looked at me directly.
"Enzo," she said, "come here."
I wagged my tail and approached cautiously. I hadn't seen her since she went into the hospital, and I wasn't prepared for what I saw. It seemed to me the hospital had made her much sicker than she really was.
"He doesn't know what to think," Denny said for me.
"It's okay, Enzo," she said.
She dangled her hand off the side of the bed, and I bumped it with my nose. I didn't like any of this. All the new furniture, Eve looking limp and sad, people standing around like Christmas without the presents. None of it seemed right. So even though everyone was staring at me, I shuffled over to Zoe and stood behind her, looking out the windows into the backyard, which was dappled with sunlight.
"I think I've offended him by being sick," she said.
That was not what I meant at all. My feelings were so complicated.
I have difficulty explaining them with any clarity even today, after I have lived through it and had time to reflect upon it. All I could do was move to her bedside and lie down before her like a rug. "I don't like seeing me like this either," she said. The afternoon was interminable. Finally, the dinner hour came, and Maxwell, Trish, and Denny poured themselves cocktails, and the mood lifted dramatically. An old photo album of Eve as a child was taken out from hiding, and everyone laughed while the smell of garlic and oil floated from the kitchen where Trish cooked the food. Eve took off her cap, and we marveled at her shaved head and grotesque scars. She showered with the help of the nurse, and when she emerged from the bathroom in one of her own dresses, and not the hospital gown and robe, she looked almost normal, though there was a darkness behind her eyes, a look of resignation. She tried to read Zoe a book, but she said she couldn't focus well enough, so Zoe tried her best to read to Eve, and her best was fairly good. I wandered into the kitchen, where Denny was again conferencing with Trish and Maxwell. "We really think Zoe should stay with us," Maxwell said. "Until..."
"Until..."
Trish echoed, standing at the stove with her back to us. So much of language is unspoken. So much of language is comprised of looks and gestures and sounds that are not words. People are ignorant of the vast complexity of their own communication. Trish's robotic repeating of the single word, "until," revealed everything about her state of mind. "Until what?" Denny demanded. I could hear the irritation in his voice. "How do you know what's going to happen? You're condemning her to something before you even know." Trish dropped her frying pan onto the burner with a loud clatter and began to sob. Maxwell wrapped his arms around her and enveloped her in his embrace. He looked over at Denny.
"Please, Denny. We have to face the reality of it. The doctor said 6 to 8 months. He was quite definite."
Trish pulled away from him and steadied herself, sniffed in her tears.
"My baby," she whispered.
"Zoe is just a child," Maxwell continued. "This is valuable time, the only time she has to spend with Eve. I can't imagine, I can't believe, for a second, that you would possibly object."
"You're such a caring person," Trish added.
I could see that Denny was stuck. He had agreed to have Eve stay with Maxwell and Trish, and now they wanted Zoe, too. If he objected, he would be keeping a mother and a daughter apart. If he accepted their proposal, he would be pushed to the periphery. He would become an outsider in his own family.
"I understand what you're saying," Denny said.
"We knew you would,"
Trish interrupted.
"But I'll have to talk to Zoe about it to see what she wants."
Trish and Maxwell looked at each other uneasily.
"You can't seriously consider asking a little girl what she wants," Maxwell snorted. "She's 5, for God's sake. She can't..."
"I'll talk to Zoe to see what she wants," Denny repeated firmly. After dinner, he took Zoe into the backyard, and they sat together on the terrace steps.
"Mommy would like it if you stayed here with her and Grandma and Grandpa," he said. "What do you think about that?"
She turned it over in her head.
"What do you think about it?"
she asked.
"Well," Denny said, "I think maybe it's the best thing. Mommy has missed you so much, and she wants to spend more time with you. It would just be for a little while, until she's better and can come home."
"Oh,"
Zoe said.
"I still get to take the bus to school?"
"Well," Denny said, thinking, "probably not. Not for a while. Grandma or Grandpa will drive you to school and pick you up, I think. When Mommy feels better, you both will come home. Then you can take the bus again."
"Oh."
"I'll come and visit every day," Denny said. "And we'll spend weekends together, and sometimes he'll stay with me, too. But Mommy really wants you with her."
Zoe nodded somberly.
"Grandma and Grandpa really want me, too," she said.
Denny was clearly upset, but he was hiding it in a way that I thought little kids didn't understand. But Zoe was very smart, like her father. Even at 5 years old, she understood.
"It's okay, Daddy," she said. "I know you won't leave me here forever."
He smiled at her and took her little kid hand and held it in his own and kissed her on the forehead.
"I promise I will never do that," he said.
It was agreed then, perhaps to neither of their satisfaction,
that she would stay. I marveled at them both. How difficult it must be to be a person. To constantly subvert your desires. To worry about doing the right thing rather than doing what is most expedient. At that moment, honestly, I had grave doubts as to my ability to interact on such a level. I wondered if I could ever become the human I hoped to be. As the night wound down, I found Denny sitting in the stuffed chair next to Eve's bed, nervously tapping his hand against his leg. "This is crazy," Denny said. "I'm going to stay, too. I'll sleep on the couch." "No, Denny," Eve said. "You'll be so uncomfortable. I've slept on plenty of couches in my life. It's fine." "Denny, please." There was something about the tone of her voice, something pleading in her eyes that made him stop. "Please go home," she said. He scratched the back of his neck and looked down. "Zoe is here," he said. "Your folks are here? You've told me you want Enzo to stay with you tonight, but you send me away? What did I do?" She sighed deeply. She was very tired and seemed like she hadn't the energy to explain it to Denny, but she tried. "Zoe won't remember," she said. "I don't care what my parents think. And Enzo, well, Enzo understands. But I don't want you to see me like this." "Like what?" "Look at me," she said. "My head is shaved. My face looks old. My breath smells like I'm rotting inside. I'm ugly." "I don't care what you look like," he said. "I see you. I see who you really are." "I care what I look like," she said, trying to muster her old Eve smile. "When I look at you, I see my reflection in your eyes. I don't want to be ugly in front of you." Denny turned away as if to shield his eyes from her, as if to take away the mirrors. He looked out the window into the backyard, which was lit with lights along the patio's edge, and more lights that were suspended in the trees, illuminating our lives. Out there, beyond the light, was the unknown. Everything that wasn't us. "I'll pack Zoe's things and come back in the morning," he said, finally, without turning around. "Thank you, Denny," Eve said, relieved. "You can take Enzo. I don't want you to feel abandoned." "No," he said. "Enzo should stay. He misses you." He kissed Eve goodnight, tucked Zoe into bed, and then he left me with Eve. I wasn't sure why she wanted me around, but I understood why she wanted Denny to go. As he fell asleep that night, she wanted him to dream of her as she used to be, not as she currently was. She didn't want Denny's vision of her to be corrupted by her presence. What she didn't understand was Denny's ability to look beyond her physical condition. He was focusing on the next turn. Perhaps if she had had the same ability, things would have turned out differently for her. The house grew quiet and dark, Zoe in bed, Maxwell and Trish in their room with their TV blinking under the door. Eve was settled into her bed in the living room with the nurse sitting in a dark corner playing a page of her word search book in which she circled the hidden messages. I lay next to Eve's bed. Later, Eve was asleep and the nurse nudged me with her foot. I lifted my head and she held a finger to her lips and told me to be a good dog and follow her, which I did. She led me through the kitchen, through the laundry room, to the back of the house, and she opened the door that led to the garage. "In you go," she said. "We don't want you disturbing Mrs. Swift during the night." I looked at her, puzzled. Disturb Eve? Why would I do that? She took my hesitation as rebellion. She snatched my collar and gave it a jerk. She shoved me into the dark garage and closed the door. I heard her slippers tread away, back into the house. I was not afraid. All I knew was how dark it was in the garage. It wasn't too cold, and it wasn't overly unpleasant, if you don't mind a concrete floor and the smell of engine oil in an absolutely pitch-black room. I'm sure there were no rats, as Maxwell kept a clean garage for his valuable cars, but I had never slept in a garage before. The time clicked by. Literally. I watched it click by on an old electric clock that Maxwell kept on the workbench he never used. It was one of those old clocks with the numbers on little plastic tabs that rotate around a spindle
illuminated by a small bulb, the only source of light in the room. Each minute was two clicks. The first when the little plastic half number was released, the second when the half number was settled, revealing an entirely new number. Click, click, and a minute went by. Click, click, and another. And that's how I passed my time in my prison, counting the clicks, and daydreaming about the movies I've seen. My two favorite actors are, in this order, Steve McQueen and Al Pacino. Bobby Deerfield is a very underappreciated film, as is Pacino's performance in it. My third favorite actor is Paul Newman, for his excellent car handling skills in the film Winning, and because he is a fantastic racer in his own right and owns a Champ Car racing team, and finally because he purchases his palm fruit oil from renewable sources in Colombia and thereby discourages the decimation of vast tracts of rainforest in Borneo and Sumatra. George Clooney is my fourth favorite actor because he's exceptionally clever at helping cure children of diseases on reruns of ER, and because he looks a little like me around the eyes. Dustin Hoffman is my fifth favorite actor, mostly because he did such great things for the Alfa Romeo trademark in The Graduate. Steve McQueen, though, is my first, and not only because of Le Mans and Bullet, two of the greatest car movies ever made, but also because of Papillon. Being a dog, I know what it's like to be locked in a prison cell without hope, every day waiting for the sliding door to open and for a metal bowl of undernourishing slop to be shoved through the slot. Hours into my nightmare, the garage door opened, and Eve was there in her nightgown, silhouetted by the nightlight in the kitchen. "Enzo?" she questioned. I said nothing, but I emerged from the darkness, relieved to see her again. "Come with me." She led me back into the living room, and she took a cushion from the sofa and placed it next to her bed. She told me to lie on it, and I did. Then she climbed into the bed and pulled up the sheets to her neck. "I need you with me," she said. "Don't go away again." But I hadn't gone away. I had been abducted. I could feel the sleep pressing down on her. "I need you with me," she said. "I'm so afraid. I'm so afraid." "It's okay," I said. "I'm here." She rolled to the edge of the bed and looked down at me, her eyes glazed. "Get me through tonight," she said. "That's all I need. Protect me. Don't let it happen tonight. Enzo, please. You're the only one who can help." "I will," I said. "You're the only one. Don't worry about that nurse. I sent her home." I looked over to the corner, and the crinkly old woman was gone. "I don't need her," she said. "Only you can protect me. Please, don't let it happen tonight." I didn't sleep at all that night. I stood guard, waiting for the demon to show his face. The demon was coming for Eve, but he would have to get past me first, and I was ready. I noted every sound, every creak, every change in air density, and by standing or shifting my weight, I silently made it clear to the demon that he would have to contend with me if he intended to take Eve. The demon stayed away. In the morning, the others awoke and cared for Eve, and I was able to relinquish my guard duties and sleep. "What a lazy dog," I heard Maxwell mutter as he passed me. And then I felt Eve's hand on my neck, stroking. "Thank you," she said. "Thank you." 24. For the first few weeks of our new arrangement, Denny and I lived in our house, while Eve and Zoe lived with the twins. Denny visited them every single evening after work, while I stayed home alone. By Halloween, Denny's pace had slowed, and by Thanksgiving, he visited them only twice during the week. Whenever he came home from the twins' house, he reported to me how good Eve looked and how much better she was getting and that she would be coming home soon. But I saw her, too, on the weekends when he would take me to visit, and I knew she wasn't getting better. And she wouldn't be coming home anytime soon. Every weekend, without fail, both Denny and I visited with Eve on Saturday when we picked up Zoe, and again on Sunday when we delivered her home after our sleepover. We frequently took our Sunday meal with the extended family. I spent the occasional night with Eve in her living room, but she never needed me as much as she had that first night when she was so afraid.
Zoe's time with us should have been filled with joy, but she didn't seem altogether happy. How could she be, living with her mother, who was dying, and not with her father, who was very much alive? Zoe's schooling had briefly become a point of contention. Shortly after she began staying with Maxwell and Trish, they asked to transfer Zoe to a school on Mercer Island, as traveling back and forth across the I-90 floating bridge twice a day was a burden for them. But Denny put his foot down, knowing how much Zoe loved her Madrona school. He insisted she remain there, as he was her father and legal guardian, and also, he maintained, since both Zoe and Eve would be moving home in the near future. Frustrated by Denny's intractability, Maxwell offered to pay for Zoe's schooling if she enrolled in a private school located on Mercer Island. Their conversations were frequent and intense. But even in the face of Maxwell's persistence, Denny proved that he had a bit of the Gila monster in him, though I don't know whether on his mother's side or his father's side, as his jaws never slackened. Eventually he prevailed, and Maxwell and Trish were forced to commute twice daily across the lake. "If they're really doing it for Zoe and Eve," Denny said to me once, "it shouldn't bother them to drive 15 minutes across the lake. It's really not that far." Denny missed Eve tremendously, I know, but he missed Zoe just as much. I could see it most on those days when he kept Zoe overnight and we got to walk her to the bus stop, usually a Monday or a Thursday. On those mornings, our house seemed filled with electricity so that neither Denny nor I needed the alarm clock to wake, but instead waited anxiously in the darkness until the hour came to rouse Zoe. We didn't want to miss a single minute we could spend with her. On those mornings, Denny was a different person altogether. The way he so lovingly packed her sack lunches, often writing a note on a piece of notepaper, a thought or a joke he hoped she would find at lunch and might make her smile. The way he took such care with her peanut butter and banana sandwiches, slicing the banana so that each slice was exactly the same thickness. I got to eat the extra banana on those occasions, which I enjoyed. I love bananas almost as much as I love pancakes, my favorite food. After Zoe drove away on the yellow bus those days, the other father with the three children would sometimes offer to buy us a coffee, and sometimes we would accept, and we would all walk to Madison to the nice bakery and drink coffee at the sidewalk tables. Until once, when the other father said, "Your wife works?" Obviously he was trying to explain to himself Eve's absence. "No," Denny replied. "She's recovering from brain cancer." The man dipped his head sadly upon hearing the situation. After that day, whenever we went to the bus stop, the man made himself busy talking to other people or checking his cell phone. We never spoke to him again. 25. In February, the black pit of winter, we went on a trip to north central Washington, to an area called the Metow Valley. It is important for United States citizens to celebrate the birthdays of their greatest presidents, so all the schools were closed for a week. Denny, Zoe, and I went to a cabin in the Snowy Mountains to celebrate. The cabin was owned by a relative of Eve's, whom I had never met. It was quite cold, too cold for me, though on the warmer afternoons I enjoyed running in the snow. I much preferred to lie by the baseboard heater and let the others do their exercises, skiing and snowshoeing and all of that. Eve, who was too weak to travel, and her parents were not there. But many others were, all of whom were relatives of some kind or another. We were only there, I overheard, because Eve had thought it was very important for Zoe to spend time with these people, since she, Eve, someone said, would die very soon. I didn't like that whole line of reasoning. First, that Eve would be dying soon, and second, that Zoe needed to spend time with people she had never met because Eve would soon die. They might have been perfectly pleasant people in their puffy pants and fleece vests and sweaters that smelled of sweat. I don't know. But I wondered why they had waited for Eve's illness to make themselves available for companionship. There were a great many of them, and I had no idea who was connected to whom. They were all cousins, I understood, but there were certain generational gaps that were confusing to me, and some of the people were without parents, but were with uncles and aunts instead, and some might have just been friends. Zoe and Denny kept mostly to themselves, but they still participated in certain group events, like horseback riding in the snow, sledding, and snowshoeing. The group meals were convivial, and though I was determined to remain aloof, one of the cousins was always willing to slip me a treat at mealtime.
and no one ever kicked me out from under the very large dining table where I lingered during dinner, even though I was breaking my own personal code, a certain sense of lawlessness pervaded the house. What, with children staying awake late into the night and adults sleeping at all hours of the day like dogs? Why shouldn't I have partaken in the debauchery? Conflicted though I was, each night something special happened that I liked very much. Outside the house, which had many identical rooms, each with many identical beds to house the multitude, was a stone patio with a large hearth. Apparently in the summer months it was used for outdoor cooking, but it was used in the winter as well. I didn't care for the stones, which were very cold and were sprinkled with salt pellets that hurt when they got wedged between my pads, but I loved the hearth. Fire, cracking and hot. It blazed in the evenings after dinner, and they all gathered, bundled in their great coats, and one had a guitar and gloves without fingertips, and he played music while they all sang. It was well below freezing, but I had my place next to the hearth, and the stars we could see, billions of them, because the night was so intensely dark, and the sounds in the distance, the snap of a snow-burdened tree branch giving way to the wind, the barking of coyotes, my brethren, calling each other to the hunt. And when the cold overpowered the heat from the hearth, we all shuffled into the house and into our separate rooms, our fur and jackets smelling of smoke and pine sap and flaming marshmallows. It was on one of the evenings while sitting around the fire that I noticed Denny had an admirer. She was young, the sister of someone whom Denny apparently had met years earlier at a Thanksgiving or an Easter, because his first comment to her and the others was about how much she had grown since he had seen her last. She was a teenager who had a full set of breasts for milking and hips wide enough for childbirth and so was, for all intents and purposes, an adult, but who still acted like a child, always asking for permission to do things. This girl, not yet a woman, was named Annika, and she was very crafty and always knew how to position herself and time her movements to force a meeting with Denny. She sat next to him around the fire. She sat across from him at meals. She always managed to be in the back seat of someone's Suburban when he was in the back seat. She laughed too loudly at every comment he made. She loved his hair after he took off his sweaty ski cap. She proclaimed an extreme admiration for his hands. She doted on Zoe. She became emotional at the mention of Eve. Denny was ignorant of her advances. I don't know if it was deliberate or not, but he certainly acted as if he hadn't a clue. Who is Achilles without his tendon? Who is Samson without Delilah? Who is Oedipus without his clubfoot? Mute by design, I have been able to study the art of rhetoric, unfettered by ego and self-interest, and so I know the answers to these questions. The true hero is flawed. The true test of a champion is not whether he can triumph, but whether he can overcome obstacles, preferably of his own making, in order to triumph. A hero without a flaw is of no interest to an audience or to the universe, which, after all, is based on conflict and opposition, the irresistible force meeting the unmovable object. Which is also why Michael Schumacher, clearly one of the most gifted Formula One drivers of all time, winner of more races, winner of more championships, holder of more pole positions than any other driver in Formula One history, is often left off of the race fans' list of favorite champions. He is unlike Ayrton Senna, who often employed the same devious and daring tactics as Schumacher, but did so with a wink, and therefore was called charismatic and emotional, rather than what they called Schumacher, cold and unapproachable. Schumacher has no flaws. He has the best car, the best financed team, the best tires, the most skill. Who can rejoice in his wins? The sun rises every day. What is to love? Lock the sun in a box. Force the sun to overcome adversity in order to rise. Then we will cheer. I will often admire a beautiful sunrise, but I will never consider the sun a champion for having risen. So, for me to relate the history of Denny, who is a true champion, without including his missteps and failings, would be doing a disservice to all involved. As the end of the week drew near, the weather reports on the radio changed, and Denny became quite tense. It was almost time to return to Seattle, and he wanted to leave,
get back on the highway and drive the 5 hours over the mountain passes to our house on the other side, which, though cold and dark and wet, was mercifully without 6 feet of base snow and sub-freezing temperatures. He needed to get